Those are people who have overcome homelessness, people who are seniors, who have disabling conditions.
The Trump administration wants to overhaul how the government funds programs for the homeless.
What are the potential consequences? It's Friday, November 14th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The U.S. did not send a delegation to the U.N.'s climate talks in Brazil.
So California is trying to step into the leadership vacuum at the summit.
The fact is that states and cities, you know, led by California, are working to fill the void.
Also, a new film traces the activism of John Lennon and Yoko Ono when they first moved to New York.
I speak with their son, Sean Ono Lennon, about what his parents stood for.
Peace and love is the answer. There's that famous quote of my dad where he says, you can't fight the man with violence, because violence is the language the powers that be understand.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump has removed tariffs on a lengthy list of items. The reversal of some of his sweeping import taxes comes after Democrats won big in last week's elections, with many candidates focusing on affordability. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has more.
The long list of items that tariffs will be removed from includes foods like fruits and vegetables, beef, and coffee. American importers paid those tariffs, with many passing costs on to U.S. consumers. Removing these tariffs could therefore lower the higher prices the tariffs caused. The tariffs that will be removed are the sweeping country-by-country tariffs Trump first introduced in April, calling them reciprocal tariffs. Recent polls have shown Americans' approval of Trump on the economy, typically a strong issue for him, has slipped. Consumer confidence has also declined. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Attorney General Pam Bondi has tapped a senior federal prosecutor to look into the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's ties with prominent Democrats, banks, and institutions. This comes after President Trump publicly called on the Justice Department to do so, NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
In a post on social media, President Trump accused Democrats of using the controversy over the Jeffrey Epstein files to deflect from their own actions in the recent government shutdown. He also called on Attorney General Pam Bondi to investigate former President Bill Clinton and other prominent Democrats whom Trump alleges were involved with Epstein. In her own social media post, Bondi said she's tapping the U.S. Attorney in Manhattan, Jay Clayton, to take the lead on the matter. The moves come as Trump continues to face questions about his own ties to Epstein, particularly after House Democrats released a batch of emails this week that raised questions as to what Trump knew about Epstein's activities with underage girls. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
A judge says he will approve OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma's deal to settle thousands of lawsuits over the toll of opioids on victims. The deal would require members of the Sackler family who own the company to pay up to $7 billion and give up ownership. The agreement replaces one the Supreme Court rejected last year, finding it would have improperly protected the family against future lawsuits. People affected by the fires in Los Angeles earlier this year are now bracing for possible debris flows as a large storm bears down on the area. Jacob Margolis with LAist has more.
The period of greatest concern is early to midday Saturday, when the heaviest part of the storm is expected to press up against the mountains, essentially squeezing out a whole lot of moisture in a short period. Evacuation warnings have been sent out in anticipation for those in and around the Eaton and Palisades fire burn scars. Rainfall totals could be close to record setting. This storm might also cause delays at LAX and even generate some small tornadoes. Luckily, those don't usually cause much damage here. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Margolis in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News. Federal health officials say 23 babies in 13 states have been sickened in a growing outbreak of infant botulism tied to ByHeart baby formula. ByHeart recalled all of its products sold in the U.S. No deaths have been reported. Botulism is a rare but serious disease that can cause paralysis and death. Symptoms can take weeks to develop. South Korea and the U.S. have finalized the terms of a broad economic and military deal. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul. That fits in with U.S. efforts to have allies spend more on defense.
The agreement was reached between President Trump and South Korean President Lee Jae-myung at a summit in South Korea last month. It includes South Korea's pledge to invest $350 billion in the U.S. in exchange for lower tariffs. Seoul says it will also boost defense spending from its current 2.3% of GDP to 3.5% as soon as possible. It'll purchase $25 billion worth of U.S. military hardware by 2030 and pay substantially more to host the roughly 28,500 U.S. troops currently based in the south. The fact sheet adds that the U.S. has agreed to let Seoul enrich uranium, reprocess spent nuclear fuel, and build nuclear-powered submarines, which Seoul says will happen in Korean shipyards. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
What's thought to be the world's largest known spider's web has been discovered in a cave on the Albanian-Greek border. Researchers published their findings in the journal Subterranean Biology of two different spider species peacefully cohabitating in the giant colony nestled in a pitch-black, sulfur-rich cave. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Now back to All Things Considered.
Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. In a major shift, the Trump administration is moving away from long-term housing for homelessness. Instead, it will ramp up funding for transitional housing that requires work and addiction treatment. Critics warn that this could push many people back on the streets. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has been covering this and joins us now. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there.
Okay, so we have been hearing President Trump weigh in a lot on homelessness this year. Can you just tell us more about what this change would mean exactly?
Yeah, this does reflect an executive order President Trump signed this summer, but it goes a lot farther. It's about a dramatic shift in how to spend nearly $4 billion in homelessness funding. That's an overall amount that is up from last year. The Federal Housing Agency, HUD, says the idea is to promote self-sufficiency and get at root causes of homelessness, which it says are specifically addiction and mental illness, very common among those living outside. Now, the changes are a rebuke to longstanding federal policy. It's called Housing First. And under that, the vast majority of this funding has long gone to permanent housing that offers people treatment, but it doesn't require it. There's been a real backlash building as homelessness has spiked to record highs, according to annual federal accounts. I spoke with Stephen Ide, who's with the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank. He's argued for a long time that these permanent housing projects are not the answer.
It turned out that the units were so expensive, they cost hundreds of thousands of dollars individually, and they took years and years to bring online. And so it was just oversold.
Now, Ide says with this change, it will be quicker and cheaper to ramp up shorter-term transitional housing, and that with mandated treatment, many could become self-sufficient.
But this is a pretty major overhaul, right? Like, what do advocacy groups who work on homelessness say about this idea?
They largely do not agree at all. I spoke with Anne Oliva. She heads the National Alliance to End Homelessness, and she used to manage HUD's homelessness programs. She says people in the agency's permanent housing need that help, and they need it long term. And her group and others calculate that shifting most money away from these kind of programs could lead as many as 170,000 people to lose housing all over again.
Those are people who have overcome homelessness, people who are seniors, who have disabling conditions. It's going to disadvantage those folks, but it also disadvantages communities really significantly because they are being expected to make massive, massive changes in a very short period of time.
And what she means there is these changes are part of a notice to apply for funding, and it's coming much later in the year than usual. Now, some programs are actually slated to run out of money before this new funding would start up.
Whoa. Okay, so then what happens next at this point?
I think next it is a big scramble, you know, for a applying for this funding and also figuring out who can apply to these new qualifications. Advocates say you can't just easily switch from Housing First to transitional, and in many cases, that's just not realistic. Also, the agency will now favor places and programs that comply with the Trump administration's policy agenda, like the president's rollback of DEI and push for homeless camping bans. And finally, in the past, a lot of this funding has basically rolled over to existing projects, but now HUD says only 30% of grants will be automatically renewed. It wants the process to be more competitive with new players at the table. So that's another way that programs who are now housing formerly homeless people could suddenly lose their funding in coming months.
That is NPR's Jennifer Ludden. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
The U.S. did not send a delegation to the U.N.'s 30th climate summit in Brazil this year. The Trump administration has taken an anti-climate stance, calling efforts to limit global warming, quote, a hoax. But delegates from California and other states are at COP30 attempting to fill the void. Laura Clivens with KQED in San Francisco reports.
California Governor Gavin Newsom says there's a need for state leaders to be in Brazil.
I'm here because I don't want the United States of America to be a footnote at this conference.
Newsom has been meeting with country leaders at COP30 on a range of issues, from biodiversity to clean energy.
California is a stable and reliable partner in low carbon green growth.
The state's representation at COP comes as President Trump has rolled back national climate policies and, for the second time, moved to take the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, which aims to limit global warming. In a White House statement to NPR, spokesperson Taylor Rogers wrote the president won't jeopardize economic and national security to, quote, pursue vague climate goals.
It's embarrassing that the federal government is missing in action on this global crisis.
Wade Crowfoot leads California's Natural Resources Agency. He's in Brazil this week with Newsom.
The fact is that states and cities, you know, led by California, are working to fill the void.
California has a long history of taking environmental action that influences the country. In the late 1950s, for example, the state established clean air standards before the Federal Clean Air Act, signed by President Richard Nixon in 1970. Over time, the state has partnered with countries like China and Australia to further clean air goals. Crowfoot says sometimes agreements are years in the making.
Really identifying capacities or technologies or expertise that one government has that the other government might be interested in.
California partnered with Brazil in September to help it set up a carbon market. Another recent deal will bring Danish flood management expertise to California's Delta region. Experts say agreements like these aren't new. They're just more visible now, given the vacuum of federal climate leadership. Casey Kadams directs the U.S. Climate Alliance, a coalition of American governors committed to keeping emissions low.
The impact of governors and mayors traveling to Brazil is to make sure that the rest of the global community recognizes how much progress the United States is still making in spite of the headwinds.
Kadam says the governors of New Mexico and Wisconsin are also at COP this year. Meanwhile, Governor Newsom has already signed even more agreements while in Brazil. One is with Colombia to address, among other things, the potent greenhouse gas methane. Another is with Nigeria to help increase adoption of electric vehicles. For NPR News, I'm Laura Clivens in San Francisco.
Alaska Native communities are still cleaning up after Typhoon Halong devastated two villages last month. Hundreds are still evacuated, and now they face another loss. One of the few sources for local news and information, public radio and television station KYUK, says it plans to cut its staff and its programming. That's after President Trump and Republicans in Congress eliminated money for public media, wiping out much of the station's funding. NPR's Jeff Brady has this story.
When the remnants of Typhoon Halong hit the village of Quigilingok on Alaska's rural southwest coast, David Ryan's house floated away with him and his four children inside. While waiting for rescuers, he talked on the phone with KYUK.
The flood lifted us up, and I didn't think it was going to happen. And I'm like, I yelled out like my kids to get up and group up here on the stairs just in case we tip over.
The house did not tip over. It hit a bridge and stopped. About four dozen homes floated away like this in the storm, thankfully inland with the storm surge and not out to sea. In this isolated village with no roads to the outside world, all-terrain vehicles are how people get around. In Quiguilangoc, KYUK is a crucial source of information, especially as a hotter climate from humans burning fossil fuels makes storms like Halong more intense. Lifelong resident Daryl John says the station's Yupik language programs are especially valuable.
A lot of great advices we listen to from the elders, any updates from any other communities, you know, what to look out for or any upcoming events.
Over more than 50 years, KYUK has become a connecting resource for this sparsely populated region, which is about the size of Louisiana. The station broadcasts from a small building at the base of a tall tower in the town of Bethel. Each weekday, as Morning Edition ends, there's local news and, very important in a place where people drive over frozen rivers in the winter, the weather forecast in the Yupik language. KYUK was already navigating funding cuts from the state of Alaska when President Trump targeted public media and Congress eliminated funding this summer. KYUK General Manager Kristen Hall says federal money essentially paid for the staff.
It's a little over $1 million that we're receiving each year from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Our salaries and benefits in FY25 was also a little over $1 million.
Federal funding has been up to 70% of KYUK's budget. Hall says the station had 10 full-time employees, but after January, that'll be down to 4. As the station transitions to more part-time and on-call workers, it's cutting a daily interview program to 2 days a week and may have to end other programs next year.
Essentially, the news director position is being cut.
Sage Smiley is currently KYUK's full-time news director. She's also the local high school swim coach and was at a meet in another city when the remnants of Typhoon Halong arrived.
I was working remotely from a minivan with the swim team while the rest of the team was working on the ground here, and we had collaborators in Anchorage who were helping draft scripts and call communities and figure out what was happening.
In January, Smiley says her hours will be reduced to about 5 per week, essentially cutting the newsroom staff by a third. The station has prioritized keeping Yupik language programs, such as the weekly talk show Yuk to Yuk, with longtime host Sam Berlin.
My employment here was hanging on by a hair. But the people, God bless them, they got together and we raised over 100,000 with our fundraiser.
That helps but doesn't fill the gap. Raising money in a region with fewer than 30,000 people and with a poverty rate that's twice the national average is difficult. The station is applying for grants, trying to sell more underwriting announcements, and will hold more pledge drives. The station hopes that will raise enough to keep KYUK on the air with a smaller staff. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Bethel, Alaska.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Support comes from AW Research Laboratories in Brainerd, reminding private well owners to test their drinking water annually. Common well contaminants such as bacteria, nitrates, and arsenic are odorless, tasteless, and colorless. More information and test kits available at awlab.com. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kivi, exploring the distinctly American art form. And tune in Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz at America Avenue. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. United Way of 1000 Lakes is currently collecting cleaning and personal hygiene items for their Home for Good drive now through December 12th. There are several drop-off sites in Grand Rapids and Deer River, including Essentia Health and Northern Star Senex. Find more info at uwlakes.org. And we receive support from the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtCenter.com. GraceHouse.org. Tickets are now on sale for Home is Where the Heart Is, a benefit for Grace House, Itasca County's only homeless shelter. The event is Thursday, December 4th, but tickets must be purchased before November 26th at Grand Rapids Super One stores, Timberlake Lodge, or Grace House. And the mountain bike trails at Tioga Recreation Area near Cohasset are closed now through November 23rd due to deer hunting. Now back to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The only full-length shows that John Lennon ever performed after the breakup of the Beatles were in 1972, the one-to-one concerts at New York's Madison Square Garden. The shows helped shine a light on deplorable conditions at a facility for disabled children. Lennon and his wife Yoko Ono had recently moved to the States, and a new documentary called One to One, John and Yoko, focuses on the 18 months they lived in a Greenwich Village apartment, dedicating themselves to political activism. It's streaming now on HBO, and their son Sean Ono Lennon was an executive producer on the film. He says the guiding principle behind his parents' activism was simple.
You know, peace and love is the answer. There's that famous quote of my dad where he says, you can't fight the man with violence, because violence is the language that, you know, the powers that be understand that. But what they can't deal with is love and humor. And I think that's kind of sums it up.
His parents seemed inseparable in their activism. I mean, John and Yoko, even that pair of names was like its own entity. And so I asked Sean, how hard was it for his mom to carve out an identity that was separate and distinct from his father's?
It was an ongoing story throughout my entire life. And I think it has a happy ending in that in the last decade or so, it seems obvious that the world has come around to appreciating my mother for who she is. But I think I would phrase it slightly differently in that it's not that she needed to carve out an identity, because she has one of the strongest, most singular identities of anyone I've ever met. But it's more that the world had to come around to seeing her for who she was,
yeah,
or who she is.
Yeah, for people who still don't know, Yoko Ono had a huge, vibrant art career before she even met your father. I mean, she still does have this huge, vibrant art career. And it feels like there has been kind of a real reset of how the public perceives Yoko Ono now, like from the woman who allegedly broke up the Beatles to a woman who has always had and still has a singular artistic vision and voice, as you mentioned, someone who has always been kind of ahead of her time. And I was wondering, what has that shift been like for you to watch as her son?
Well, one thing that my mother always said was that she would take all of the negative energy, you know, the anti-Yoko hatred, and she would say that energy is just energy, so you can turn it into anything you like. And she always said that she would take that negative energy and turn it into something productive and creative. And I did watch her kind of do that. It never brought her down. It never stopped her from creating and putting herself out there. And I really think that it paid off. Ultimately, it made me really feel pretty good about my own life, just because, you know, you never know how long it'll take for people to appreciate you if you just kind of hang on and don't give up.
What do you think is still the most misunderstood thing about Yoko Ono?
Okay, well, the most misunderstood thing is that she can't sing. because I will say,
you need to watch this documentary, people.
Yeah.
Because, yes, I agree with you.
And, you know, I understand. I don't blame people for not appreciating a certain style of my mother's more experimental vocalizations.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is unfortunate about it is that that kind of avant-garde you know, howling, as it were, really overshadows the fact that she does have very beautiful conventional songs as well.
Yeah.
And almost no one has heard those because they don't get the attention. But she sings and writes beautifully, I think. And she has many facets to her, you know, musical vocabulary.
You know, I've been a huge Beatles fan my entire life, but I had never seen footage of your dad perform the song Mother until I watched this documentary. Mm. And it's a song about how your father felt the loss of both his parents, a loss of different kinds. And to watch your dad's face while he was singing Mother was so moving to me. Mm. And it made me wonder about you. What was that like for you to see your dad perform this song, mourning the absence of his parents? Because obviously you've had to mourn the absence of one of your parents. How do you think about that, what you and your father shared in terms of the loss of at least one parent?
Well, you know, I've got to say it's heavy, man. It's a heavy performance, specifically the one you're talking about. But the thing that I remember most about it is that there's a moment where he hits a wrong key on the Wurlitzer.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives a little cheeky grin and kind of smiles at the audience, kind of acknowledging that he made a mistake. And that sort of sums up my dad to me. It's like, even in the most serious times, he always could crack a joke or make you smile.
Love and humor.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's sort of the essence of what I think is beautiful about the John and Yoko thing, is that it's actually, they're talking about serious stuff, but they do it with a lot of fun and humor. I mean, look at the bed in, you know? It's hilarious. They're literally
in bed.
They're in bed and everyone's making fun of them. And to this day, I see people, you know, talking about the bed in, like, look, they had a maid and they were protesting, you know, why couldn't they make their own bed? And I'm like, you guys are just falling for it.
Right.
Because the whole thing was to get attention for the peace movement. And it was funny and they knew it was funny.
Well, you and your dad famously share the same birthday, October 9th, which coincidentally, Sean, is also my dad's birthday, October 9th.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's any personality overlap?
Oh my God. My dad's a huge fan of your dad. And mm-hmm. And yes, my dad can absolutely laugh at the most serious moments while we're all feeling very grave about something.
Yeah.
So there is a connection there. But I wanted to ask you, you're 50 years old now. You're a decade older than your dad was when he died. How much do you think about that, about how much longer you have lived compared to your father?
It is a little bit weird. It just feels, it's existentially challenging because I look at him, you know, in his late 30s, and I see him as older than me. And I can't help it. I don't know if that'll ever change. Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, it's kind of like the way my mother looks at me and she still thinks of me as a kid, and it just kind of never ends. So there is a little bit of cognitive dissonance, I would say. It's hard for me to believe that I'm older than he was. But also, I do think that for whatever reason, maybe it's my Japanese genes or whatever, but I do feel like I still look possibly younger than he did. And
you
I don't know
do.
if we lived different lives. Or if people are just eating healthier in my
Asian
generation.
Asian don't raisin.
Yeah, exactly. Yellow don't mellow is what I say.
That rhymes better.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's politically correct or not.
Sean Ono Lennon is the executive producer for the new documentary One to One, John and Yoko. It was so lovely to talk to you, Sean. It really was.
Thank you. But I never
left you. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwoods since 1930. Patterson's feature clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smart Wool. Patterson'sClothing.com. Now it's time for the Up North Report here on KAXE KBXE.
KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. A Clearwater County deputy shot and killed a man Thursday following a car chase in Bagley. The events leading up to the incident began just after noon when a sheriff's deputy recognized a man with a felony warrant for his arrest at the Bagley Senex gas station. The man fled the scene, driving east on Highway 2 before turning onto a residential street. Law enforcement stopped the vehicle after the man drove into a yard. The release states while law enforcement attempted to get the man out of the vehicle, he fired a flare-type projectile at them. A deputy shot the man, who died on scene despite life-saving measures performed with the assistance of the Sanford Health Bagley Ambulance Service. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension was called in to investigate. The Brainerd Lakes area is mourning the loss of longtime newspaper photographer Steve Coles. Coles died Monday after a brief stint of pancreatic cancer. Chelsea Perkins reflects on his legacy.
Likely hundreds of thousands of people have been captured by the lens of Steve Coles in the more than five decades he covered local news. Coles had a brief stint at the Lake Country Echo and Pequot Lakes and a couple of other papers, but he began his Brainerd Dispatch career in 1975 and worked there until shortly before his death. When the Dispatch announced his passing, an outpouring of tributes rolled in from people who knew Coles in many walks of life. As a photography instructor at Central Lakes College, a scuba diver who loved the Cuyuna mine pits, and as a member of the AA community who recently celebrated 46 years of sobriety. I knew Steve as a friend and mentor who I worked with for 9 years at the Dispatch, where I served as community editor. In 2017, he sat down with me to talk about his work for a podcast episode.
If you are a young person, or a person out there who feels like they don't quite fit in, and maybe what you need to do is learn to express yourself with a camera. And when that happens, when you learn to express yourself with a camera, a lot of the good things begin to happen in your life because you suddenly become happy.
From sporting events to first days of school, annual festivals to spontaneous gatherings, moments of triumph and devastating tragedies, Coles saw it all and documented it as part of the first draft of history. Asked how he hoped readers felt when they saw his work, he had this to say.
I take pictures for the people who live in high rises or can't get out, and they can see what's going on in the community, not necessarily the good, the bad, whatever, but basically, some days we need a shot of the dog catching the frisbee.
A visitation will be 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday at Nelson Dorn Funeral Home in Brainerd. His funeral will be 1 p.m. Monday at Lord of Life Lutheran Church in Baxter, and burial will follow at Brainerd's Evergreen Cemetery at 3:30. All are welcome to attend any events. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
I pledge to engage peacefully with my fellow Minnesotans, work in good faith to resolve disputes.
Shannon Watson presented the Civic Pledge for a Stronger Minnesota to a small group in Grand Rapids on Thursday. Watson is the founder and executive director of nonpartisan civic and political engagement nonprofit Majority in the Middle. It created the pledge with its partners earlier this year in response to the politically motivated assassination of Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman and her husband and the shooting of State Senator John Hoffman and his wife. Current and former state legislators, city councilors, and business and other community leaders gathered to take the step toward bridging divides, improving trust, and empowering civility. The pledge isn't just for officials. Anyone can sign it online. Republican State Representative Spencer Igo of Wabana Township says civility starts at the legislature.
But also requires our communities as well. If we want to change things, it's going to require us to start talking to our friends, family, and neighbors. That we need to bring the temperature down.
Presenters acknowledge that there aren't easy solutions to the national issues of polarization and violence, but they want the pledge to lead to better standards of behavior in civic life. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. The court of the internet interested in wristwatches was the first to spot the new desktop clock. It appeared in recent photographs of President Trump at work in the Oval Office. The watch-watching websites, Watches of Espionage and Hodinkee, were able to confirm this was a gift from the CEO of Rolex. Last week, Trump met with him and several Swiss business executives at the White House, where the Swiss newspaper Blick reported a different CEO gifted Trump an engraved gold bar. And today, the White House announced that tariffs on Swiss imports had been dropped from 39% to a more manageable 15%. Now, it was the governments of Switzerland and the United States that hammered out this deal, not business leaders. But this is not the first time that foreign gifts to the U.S. president have lined up with foreign policy. And this felt like a good time to take stock of the trends that we have seen this year. Richard Painter is a law professor at the University of Minnesota and was former chief White House ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
What did you make of the president of the United States being given a Rolex and a gold bar by executives who had a lot to gain from lower tariffs?
I certainly view this as inappropriate. It appears as if there's a quid pro quo of a gift from foreign interests to the president in return for concession on tariffs. And once this precedent is set, we'll have other countries and industries offering the same. And this is a matter of grave concern for the United States. It's unconstitutional in the United States for the president or anyone else in a position of power to receive anything of value from a foreign government. That is unconstitutional. But if the gift is from a foreign corporation or private interest, it's not technically prohibited under the Monuments Clause of the Constitution. But it's still a very, very dangerous precedent to set that foreign interests can give gifts to the president and then get a concession on tariffs or anything else.
There's also something we've seen with both Trump administrations that other presidents put guardrails around them. They followed norms. They followed accepted practices. And President Trump has just often made it clear he's not interested in following that. Is that an accurate way to frame it?
There's a very accurate way to frame it. And the president feels he has the wind at his back because the Supreme Court has ruled that a president can never be prosecuted for a criminal act within his core constitutional powers. And President Trump believes that just about everything is within his core constitutional powers. And we also have a Congress that won't do anything about this, that won't hold the president to account.
What normally happens under standard procedure when an executive or another world leader gives the president of the United States an official gift, especially an expensive gift, which I'm sure happens all the time, especially during a meeting talking about a policy change that could benefit that company or that country?
In the Bush White House, when I was the chief White House ethics lawyer, when gifts were given to the president, it was brought to my attention, and only in a very, very rare circumstances did the president accept the gift, and the president would never accept a gift in his personal capacity from a foreign power in excess of that which has been authorized by Congress, and the maximum there now is $480. Anything else cannot be a gift to the president. Could be potentially a gift to the United States from the foreign country, like the French gave us the Statue of Liberty and so forth. But the president, in his personal capacity, the maximum is $480.
The Rolex clock in question, which I'm quite sure is over that threshold, was technically a gift to the American people. Does that matter to you? Is that a technical difference? Is that an important difference?
Well, technically, let's see where it ends up. Is it going to end up like the 747 airplane from Qatar in the presidential library of Donald Trump, which will be a private organization? That's not a gift to the American people. And quite frankly, we don't need a clock. That's not what the United States needs.
What is your pitch to the most skeptical listener out there that these types of regulations and norms matter?
The integrity of our government matters. We have a government that spends $1 trillion on defense alone, on our military. This is a government which we have the right to expect to serve the interests of the United States and its citizens, and to put America first, not to simply repeat the America First slogan and then turn around and have foreign or economic policy influenced by the private financial interests of those who have power.
That was Richard Pater, law professor at the University of Minnesota and the former chief White House ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Jordan is one of the most water-scarce countries in the world. This year, drought and higher temperatures have led to a sharp decline in the country's most important crop, olives. As correspondent Jane Arath tells us, it's so bad that this year, the country is importing olive oil.
At a mosque on the outskirts of Amman and across Jordan, worshippers are praying for rain. In what would normally be the rainy season, most parts of the country haven't received any at all. Imam Muhammad El-Zaghu tells us that throughout Islamic history, people prayed for rain and received it. On a small farm near the city of Salt, filmmaker Miriam Shaheen's family has grown rain-fed olives for decades.
Traditional olive harvesters don't add water. They just leave things to rainwater, and that rainwater wasn't available this year.
She says in normal years, the olive harvest would produce about 12 4-gallon canisters of oil.
When it was bad, when the season wasn't so good, it would be 8 or 9. And this year, for the first time, it was 2.
Like most small producers, she normally sells the surplus or gives it as gifts. This year, there isn't enough for that. For the first time in years, in fact, Jordan, which heavily regulates its olive oil industry, is allowing imports. At a small olive pressing plant nearby, there's the clanging of machines as growers bring their olives to be turned into cold-pressed extra virgin oil without using heat or chemicals. Saddam Al-Abadi, an official in the Amman municipality, has brought olives from the family's thousands of trees. This year is one of the worst seasons in olive and other crops because of the lack of rain and climate change, he says. Their harvest was just 10% of last year's. The government doesn't allow farmers here to dig wells, and buying water is too expensive. Farmers watch as their olives are loaded on a conveyor belt, rinsed and then pressed. Minutes later, golden green olive oil pours out into stainless steel tanks. Outside, farmers are still arriving with olives. And then, as Shaheen stands outside, it starts to rain.
Oh my God. Oh my God, it's wonderful. We have rain.
It's rain.
It's rain. It's rain. It's rain.
It rains for less than a minute. For this season, much too little and too late. For NPR News, I'm Jane Arath, near Salt, Jordan.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A decades-long boom in brain science in the United States may be heading for a bust. Ongoing disruptions in federal funding are causing many young neuroscientists to reconsider their careers. NPR's John Hamilton reports that losing these scientists could slow research on everything from autism to Alzheimer's.
About 20,000 brain scientists are expected to gather in San Diego this weekend for the annual meeting of the Society for Neuroscience. But Clara Zundel, a postdoctoral researcher at Wayne State University, won't be there.
Because of the funding changes, you know, I had to consider travel costs this year.
Zundel studies how pollution affects the developing brain. Her work is funded by the National Institutes of Health. But since President Trump took office, the NIH has been buffeted by cuts, grant terminations, and abrupt policy changes. So Zundel is unsure whether support for her research will continue or if she'll be able to find a steady job.
Many universities are still on partial or even full hiring freezes. And so it's just made it really, really scary to think about how I'm going to take that next step.
Even so, Zundel isn't ready to abandon her career plans just yet.
Talk to me in another 3 months and I might change my mind, but I absolutely love what I do. I want to continue doing what I do, and I want to continue to do that here in the United States.
Other young researchers are less certain, says John Morrison, a professor at the University of California, Davis, and president of the Society for Neuroscience.
You hear things like, I've prepared my whole life for this. Is it gone now? Is it no longer possible to be the scientist that I always wanted to be? Many will just choose something else.
Or take their research to another country. Morrison says what's at stake is the next generation of scientists who will study the circuitry underlying disorders like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and schizophrenia.
The U.S. has been a world leader in research for decades, and that leadership position is now at risk.
The NIH often awards 5-year grants, and scientists tend to structure their research around that timeline. But Morrison says many awarded grants have been paused or summarily terminated by the Trump administration.
If you disrupt the grant in the middle of it, you're going to disrupt that whole progression. And you'll get to a point where the work that you've already done is worthless.
Federal health officials say the cuts reflect an effort to reduce waste and support of woke science and align research with the administration's priorities. Morrison says cuts can produce short-term savings, but in the long run, he says the human and financial costs will be huge.
We often quote Mary Lasker, who was a renowned advocate for biomedical research and launched the Lasker Prize. And she said, if you think research is expensive, try disease.
Brain science has long enjoyed bipartisan support in Congress. Diane Lipscomb, a professor at Brown University, is chair of government and public affairs at the Society for Neuroscience. She says one reason lawmakers support basic research is that ever since World War II, it has been a huge boost to the U.S. economy.
I don't think we've ever talked to anyone in the Congress who disagreed with that.
But cuts and disruptions have come from the executive branch, not Congress. So neuroscientists are taking their case directly to the public. The Society's website, for example, now includes videos of scientists explaining what they do and why it matters. Lipscomb thinks that message will be heard. And when she talks to young scientists asking for career advice, she tries to offer an optimistic message.
You just have to stay with what you know is what you love, because things will get better.
At least that's the hope. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. The Bemidji Area Arts Endowment is hosting a fundraiser Saturday, November 15th at 7 p.m. at The Loft. Art Shines Bright will feature an evening of entertainment with modern dance, instrumental and vocal performances, a theatrical production, and more. Get tickets through the Northwest Minnesota Foundation at nwmf.org. And we receive support from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving the Northland for over 25 years on the Beltline in Hibbing. Their service center provides regular maintenance and major auto repairs weekdays from 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. More details online at hibbingchrysler.us. The Bemidji Symphony Orchestra presents Pathway to Dignity Sunday, November 16th at 3 p.m. at the Bemidji High School Auditorium. They will be accepting donations of new or gently used gloves, socks, hats, and scarves that will be distributed to several nonprofit organizations. The Arrowhead Library System presents Songs of Mesabi, a musical journey through the Iron Range with Greg Tiburzi, now through December 10th. Find a list of dates, times, and locations at alslib.info. Great Lakes Area Performing Arts will hold auditions for the Tin Woodman of Oz, November 17th and 18th, from 6 to 9 both nights at Pequot Lakes High School Auditorium. There are roles for adults and youth ages 10 and up. The Bemidji Senior Center is looking for donations of holiday decorations ahead of their sale on December 5th. Donations may be dropped off at the Senior Center on 3rd Street in downtown Bemidji, weekdays from 9 to 4.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. On Sunday, Chileans will cast their ballots in the first round of a general election for president and Congress. It's a campaign that highlights the country's deep political polarization, and the alternatives in the presidential race could hardly be starker, as John Bartlett reports from the capital, Santiago.
In Chile right now, it feels like you can't turn a corner without running into a rally or campaign event. Eight presidential candidates, ranging from the far left to far right, are vying to lead Chile into a new era. 4 years after winning on a social justice agenda, President Gabriel Boric is leaving office. But now, public security has become the focus of the campaigns. Leading the polls in this first round of voting is Janet Jara, a Communist Party politician and former Boric minister. Her program promises a minimum income of around $780 per month, cash transfers to workers, and subsidies for small businesses. I feel like Jara is the candidate who is closest to the reality in Chile. Florencia Varas, a 23-year-old theatre student, told me in the square in Maipú, a southern Santiago district. Obviously, security is important, but I don't think everything they're saying is real. Chile is not a dangerous place. But not everyone sees it that way. On the right, concerns over crime and migration are driving a surge that could shape December's runoff, with many voters likely uniting behind ultra-conservative José Antonio Kast. Kast, the Catholic father of nine, was roundly defeated by Boric in 2021's presidential election. At his campaign's closing rally in a cavernous concert venue in Santiago, thousands waved red, white and blue Chilean flags and music blared as Kast outlined his plans for building hundreds of miles of border walls, a spectacle that had a distinctly Trumpian ring.
Chile tiene graves problemas ahora en su economía, en su seguridad.
Roberto Weber helped co-found Kast's Republican Party in 2017. He believes Chile's economy, security, and healthcare can only be saved by Kast. The greatest challenge to Kast is coming from even further to the right. Johannes Kaiser, a radical libertarian YouTuber known for mocking the victims of Chile's dictatorship and questioning women's right to vote, has gained a following that could shape the final round of the campaign in December. At Kaiser's closing rally, supporters wrapped in Chile flags sported Make Chile Great Again caps. And others wore vicious anti-communist slogans on t-shirts and pins, while vendors sold mock ID cards featuring the image of Chile's former dictator, General Augusto Pinochet. One tattooed 26-year-old student, who asked not to be named for fear of retribution from the left, proudly explained that her anti-communist t-shirt, printed with the date of General Pinochet's coup d'etat, was a celebration of the freedom that his 17-year dictatorship brought Chile. As the national anthem struck up behind us, she explained that she finds Kaiser the most sensible and straight-talking of the candidates. If no candidate secures more than 50% of the vote to win outright on Sunday, as is expected, a runoff will be held on the 14th of December. And the most likely outcome is that Chileans will be left with a stark choice between the Communist Party's Jara and one of her two far-right rivals. Whatever the result on Sunday, a choice between two drastically different visions for the future will face Chileans in the second round. For NPR News, I'm John Bartlett in Santiago, Chile.
Scientists have extracted something remarkable from a woolly mammoth from the last ice age, and it offers a glimpse into what was happening inside this ancient animal's cells when it died. Here's science reporter Ari Daniel.
It was 2012 when paleogeneticist Lieuwe Dallaine first laid eyes on a special specimen in a lab in eastern Siberia.
Our Russian collaborators said, come here, and there's this, you know, dead mammoth lying there, and you can't
believe your eyes, really, because it's so well preserved. It's a kind of, you know, holy hell moment when you see this.
The animal had been found thawing out of a permafrost cliff near the Siberian coastline, says Dalen, who works at Stockholm University, not quite the entire body of a juvenile mammoth.
It does have deep scratch marks on its hindquarters. It either was attacked by cave lions while it was alive, or maybe cave lions were kind of scavenging on it after it had died.
It was then buried and frozen for some 39,000 years. The Russians named the animal, which they thought was female based on visual inspection, Yuka. Over the years, researchers had studied Yuka's DNA,
which is kind of a recipe for how to make a mammoth.
But Dalen and his colleagues wondered about its RNA, the flurry of molecules that basically translate that recipe into the building of an actual mammoth.
The RNA molecules instruct the cells how and when to make proteins. What makes cells different is the RNA activity in them, which genes are turned on and off.
If Dalen could get RNA out of Yuka, he'd have a snapshot of the genes in use around the moment it died. The problem was that RNA doesn't usually hang around for very long, mere minutes, maybe hours, generally not millennia.
It felt like this is a very high-risk project.
Dalen and his team collected samples from 10 different mammoths, including Yuka, and painstakingly worked to extract RNA.
And then validating it, you know, to make sure that is it really mammoth RNA?
After churning through gigabytes of data, something unmistakable emerged, says Dalen. Woolly mammoth RNA. Most of it was too fragmented, but three of the mammoths had sufficient material to analyze, including Yuka, whose muscle had been sampled. Some of the RNA related to muscle function, not that surprising, but the team also found RNA produced in response to stress.
That would be consistent with an animal being chased down by cave lions. But of course, there could also be other explanations.
In addition, some of the animal's RNA and DNA, it turned out, came from a Y chromosome. So genetically, Yuka was actually a male. All told, Dalen says the results are a stunning proof of principle, that it's possible to know which genes were once active in a now extinct animal.
You're actually seeing processes going on inside the cells right around the time it died, and these processes have then been frozen in time for 40,000 years.
The results are published in the journal Cell.
Having this information adds to our understanding of how these creatures lived.
Maria Avila Arcos is an evolutionary genomicist at the National Autonomous University of Mexico who wasn't involved in the study. She's excited by the results, and not just for mammoths. She says they point the way to the potential study of ancient RNA viruses that have infected humans.
A lot of very important pathogens like Ebola, COVID, influenza, they have RNA genomes. But if we want to understand their evolution or how these viruses have impacted populations in the past, well, we need to be able to recover RNA from ancient samples.
In other words, Yuka's RNA has opened a window for us to consider its past while allowing scientists to dream about all the discoveries that lie ahead. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Support for KAXE comes from the Third Coast Chamber Collective, presenting chamber music up north, featuring an internationally renowned accordion and violin ensemble from Poland at Co House on November 20th at 7 p.m. Tickets available at thirdcoastchambercollective.com. Weather tonight, slight chance of rain, mostly cloudy, lows 31 to 39 degrees, south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming northwest, possible gusts up to 20 miles per hour.